I'm Eric Felton, and this is VOA's coverage of U.S. President Barack Obama's address to Muslims around the world. I'd like to welcome all of you joining us today on VOA Radio, television, and on VOAnews.com. We'll be going shortly to Cairo University in Egypt, where Mr. Obama will be delivering a speech outlining how he hopes to remake relations between the United States and countries in the Muslim world. Mr. Obama says he wants to open a dialogue that will dispel the misapprehensions that Muslims have about the West and the West has about Muslims. He also hopes this dialogue will help the United States in its efforts to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. If we are engaged in speaking directly to the Arab street, Mr. Obama said, they and their leadership are more inclined and able to work with us. The speech is also meant to reach out to those who might otherwise be tempted to engage in terrorism. The battle against terrorist extremists involves changing the hearts and minds of the people they recruit from, Mr. Obama said. Over the next hour, in addition to bringing you President Obama's speech in its entirety, we will provide analysis and insight from Cairo, Jerusalem, Kabul, London, and here in Washington. And we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts on the speech to ObamaSpeech@VOAnews.com or visit our website at VOAnews.com for other ways to share your opinions of today's speech. Joining me now to discuss the expectations for Mr. Obama's speech are here with me in our Washington studio, Muqtadir Khan, Director of the Islamic Studies Program at the University of Delaware. And in London, Muhammad Abdul Bari, Secretary General of the Muslim Council of Britain. And in Kabul, Afghanistan, Wadir Safi, a professor of law and political science at Kabul University. Welcome and thanks for joining us. Muqtadir Khan, let's start by asking, why Cairo? Why not Indonesia or Saudi Arabia as a venue to speak to the Muslim world?
Well, clearly there are two reasons why he chose Cairo. One is that Cairo has been the center of Arab intellectualism for a long time. So I think that the Obama administration, while is using the word the Muslim world, is still thinking of the Muslim world with the Arab world as its heart. So essentially his message is to Arabs and Muslims, and therefore it's coming from Cairo. And secondly, I think that he wanted to choose a capital which will once again strengthen the so-called moderate Arab countries that support the United States. So either he could have done this from Riyadh or Cairo, and since Cairo has been a long-term ally of the United States, he chose Cairo. It would have been interesting if he chose some place like Islamabad, where there is an enormous tension with the United States right now, and people, if you were to pick a country where people are most suspicious of U.S. intentions in the Muslim world, that would be Pakistan. So I wish he had chosen Islamabad.
Muhammad Abdul Bari, are you there in London?
I'm there, yeah.
Yes. President George W. Bush was not particularly popular in the Arab and Muslim world. President Obama is viewed much more positively according to public opinion polls. Is President Obama likely to be able to make his personal popularity translate into a more positive view of the United States?
Well, he has started this new conversation, and that's important that he has done that. And it all depends what policy he brings in and whether there's an implementation strategy in whatever he is saying. It all depends on how these things go in future.
Wadir Safi, are you there in Kabul, Afghanistan?
Yes.
We have a slight bit of a delay, which is okay, but the Muslim world is a very broad place, far beyond just the Arab world. Are people in other parts of the Muslim world, such as Afghanistan, going to be looking for different things from President Obama than people perhaps in the Arab world might be looking for?
I think what Mr. Obama is going to send a message in a speech to the whole Muslim world as a whole, it will affect in the Islamic community and hearts and minds of the Muslim people of Afghanistan as well. For the Afghans, if there is no problem in Palestine, they are more happy than anywhere else. But the message they convey, the President Obama is conveying in his speech, it will reach to them immediately, and it will affect, and they have already felt since his new strategy, and now they are thinking that he takes the steps practically to bring into practice whatever he had promised while he was campaigning for his presidency.
Mukhtar Khan, both Mohammed Abdel Bari and Wadi Safa talk about their need for practical steps, some kind of clear program, not just good words in the speech. What kinds of practical steps do you think people are going to be looking for?
See, I think this is the last speaking event. After this, speeches are not going to suffice. People have been anticipating this speech for a long time, and they want to see what is the full extent of reach that President Obama wants to extend towards the Muslim world. But they do want to see concrete steps, and there are three areas in the Muslim world where the U.S. needs to show that its policies has changed. And those are clearly the Arab-Israeli conflict, Iraq, and U.S. policy in South Asia and Afghanistan and Pakistan. Many people in the Muslim world understand that the U.S. had to go into Afghanistan, but they do not understand why the United States is pursuing a policy which is destabilizing Pakistan, forcing that country to fight a civil war. Now some Pakistanis are beginning to recognize the danger of the Talibanization of Pakistan and are now fighting a war to protect themselves. But on the Arab-Israeli conflict, the President Obama has taken significant steps. He has demanded that Israel fulfill its obligations by stopping the extension and rebuilding of settlements. But the Muslim world wants to see, is America going to play a balanced role in the Middle East, or is it going to be essentially an uncritical supporter of Israel? That's probably the biggest litmus test which the United States has to follow. If Obama succeeds in helping create a Palestinian state, I can guarantee you that would be the biggest change that can come in American-Muslim relations.
Well, Mohammed Abdel Bari, is there any sense that this speech will make President Obama's efforts to pursue those concrete steps any easier?
I agree with Dr. Mukhtar Khan. I think this is probably the last chance of his speaking to the people. Now people really want to see what exactly comes, especially I agree with the issues, Palestine-Israeli issue, and also the U.S. soldiers in the Muslim countries, Iraq, Afghanistan, and these are the major issues. But I'll probably add another one, which is U.S. has nearly 6 million Muslims who are very, very skilled people from the Muslim community. And so far, we haven't seen any senior appointment, or President Obama hasn't visited a single mosque. So these are the issues American Muslims do really ask. I had been visiting America in the last couple of months, and tensions have eased, but these are the issues people do really raise. So it's a holistic process that Obama needs to address, and I think he's in the right direction. We just need to see what he delivers.
Wadi Safi, what's your sense of Mr. Obama's ability to use this speech to make it more possible to deliver the specifics that people are looking for?
Yes, I think this kind of a speech from a world leader and great power of the world, it was very necessary at this moment in order psychologically to affect the Muslim world as a whole, and that whatever the expressions and terminology which were using by the same great power but another president before Obama, it was not very friendly expressions. They were saying the Islamic terrorism, they were saying the enemies who are with us, our friends who are not with us, they are our enemies. These expressions are abolished anymore, I think, in this speech. And this will be the first big step in order to make the atmosphere better for the friendly relation with the Muslim countries, especially in this part of Asia, in South Asia and Afghanistan, that they will expect and the bitterness.
And I think we're about ready here for Mr. Obama to come to the podium. And here now is the President of the United States.
سيداتي وسيداتي رئيس الولايات المتحدة. شكرا جزيلا. شكرا لكم. شكرا.
Thank you very much.
شكرا جزيلا لكم جميعا. رجاء تفضل.
Thank you.
شكرا. شكرا جزيلا. طاب يومكم. أنا يشرفني
to be in the timeless city of Cairo and to be hosted by two remarkable institutions. For over 1,000 years, Al-Azhar has stood as a beacon of Islamic learning. And for over a century, Cairo University has been a source of Egypt's advancement. And together, you represent the harmony between tradition and progress. I'm grateful for your hospitality and the hospitality of the people of Egypt. And I'm also proud to carry with me the goodwill of the American people and a greeting of peace from Muslim communities in my country. Assalamu alaikum. We meet at a time of great tension between the United States and Muslims around the world. Tension rooted in and religious wars. More recently, tension has been fed by colonialism that denied rights and opportunities to many Muslims. In a Cold War in which Muslim-majority countries were too often treated as proxies without regard to their own aspirations. Moreover, the sweeping change brought by modernity and globalization led many Muslims to view the West as hostile to the traditions of Islam. Violent extremists have exploited these tensions in a small but potent minority of Muslims. The attacks of September 11, 2001, and the continued efforts of these extremists to engage in violence against civilians has led some in my country to view Islam as inevitably hostile not only to America and Western countries, but also to human rights. All this has bred more fear and more mistrust. So long as our relationship is defined by our differences, we will empower those who sow hatred rather than peace, those who promote conflict rather than the cooperation that can help all of our people achieve justice and prosperity. And this cycle of suspicion and discord must end. I've come here to Cairo to seek a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world, one based on mutual interest and mutual respect, and one based upon the truth that America and Islam are not exclusive and need not be in competition. Instead, they overlap and share common principles, principles of justice and progress, tolerance, and the dignity of all human beings. I do so recognizing that change cannot happen overnight. I know no single speech can eradicate years of mistrust. nor can I answer in the time that I have this afternoon all the complex questions that brought us to this point. But I am convinced that in order to move forward, we must say openly to each other the things we hold in our hearts, and that too often are said only behind closed doors. There must be a sustained effort to listen to each other, to learn from each other, to respect one another, and to seek common ground. As the Holy Quran tells us, be conscious of God and speak always the truth. That is what I will try to do today, to speak the truth as best I can, humbled by the task before us, and firm in my belief that the interests we share as human beings are far more powerful than the forces that drive us apart. Now, part of this conviction is rooted in my own experience. I'm a Christian, but my father came from a Kenyan family that includes generations of Muslims. As a boy, I spent several years in Indonesia and heard the call of the azan at the break of dawn and at the fall of dusk. As a young man, I worked in Chicago communities where many found dignity and peace in their Muslim faith. As a student of history, I also know civilization's debt to Islam. It was Islam at places like Uluzar that carried the light of learning through so many centuries, paving the way for Europe's Renaissance and enlightenment. It was innovation in Muslim communities that developed the order of algebra, our magnetic compass and tools of navigation, our mastery of pens and printing, our understanding of how disease spreads and how it can be healed. Islamic culture has given us majestic arches and soaring spires, timeless poetry and cherished music, elegant calligraphy, and places of peaceful contemplation. And throughout history, Islam has demonstrated through words and deeds the possibilities of religious tolerance and racial equality. I also know that Islam has always been a part of America's story. The first nation to recognize my country was Morocco. In signing the Treaty of Tripoli in 1796, our second president, John Adams, wrote, "The United States has in itself no character of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of Muslims." And since our founding, American Muslims have enriched the United States. They have fought in our wars, they have served in our government, they have stood for civil rights, they have started businesses, they have taught at our universities, they've excelled in our sports arenas, they've won Nobel Prizes, built our tallest building, and lit the Olympic torch. And when the first Muslim American was recently elected to Congress, he took the oath to defend our Constitution using the same Holy Quran that one of our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, kept in his personal library. So I have known Islam on three continents before coming to the region where it was first revealed. That experience guides my conviction that partnership between America and Islam must be based on what Islam is, not what it isn't. And I consider it part of my responsibility as President of the United States to fight against negative stereotypes of Islam wherever they appear. But that same principle must apply to Muslim perceptions of America. Just as Muslims do not fit a crude stereotype, America is not the crude stereotype of a self-interested empire. The United States has been one of the greatest sources of progress that the world has ever known. We were born out of revolution against an empire. We were founded upon the ideal that all are created equal. And we have shed blood and struggled for centuries to give meaning to those words within our borders and around the world. We are shaped by every culture, drawn from every end of the earth, and dedicated to a simple concept, e pluribus unum, out of many, one. Now, much has been made of the fact that an African American with the name Barack Hussein Obama could be elected president. But my personal story is not so unique. The dream of opportunity for all people has not come true for everyone in America, but its promise exists for all who come to our shores. And that includes nearly 7 million American Muslims in our country today, who, by the way, enjoy incomes and educational levels that are higher than the American average. Moreover, freedom in America is indivisible from the freedom to practice one's religion. That is why there is a mosque in every state in our union and over 1,200 mosques within our borders. That's why the United States government has gone to court to protect the right of women and girls to wear the hijab and to punish those who would deny it. So let there be no doubt. Let there be no doubt, Islam is a part of America. And I believe that America holds within her the truth that regardless of race, religion, or station in life, all of us share common aspirations. To live in peace and security, to get an education and to work with dignity, to love our families, our communities, and our God. These things we share. This is the hope of all humanity. Of course, recognizing our common humanity is only the beginning of our task. Words alone cannot meet the needs of our people. These needs will be met only if we act boldly in the years ahead. And if we understand that the challenges we face are shared, and our failure to meet them will hurt us all. For we have learned from recent experience that when a financial system weakens in one country, prosperity is hurt everywhere. When a new flu infects one human being, all are at risk. When one nation pursues a nuclear weapon, the risk of nuclear attack rises for all nations. When violent extremists operate in one stretch of mountains, people are endangered across an ocean. When innocents in Bosnia and Darfur are slaughtered, that is a stain on our collective conscience. That is what it means to share this world in the 21st century. That is the responsibility we have to one another as human beings. And this is a difficult responsibility to embrace. For human history has often been a record of nations and tribes, and yes, religions, subjugating one another in pursuit of their own interests. Yet in this new age, such attitudes are self-defeating. Given our interdependence, Any world order that elevates one nation or a group of people over another will inevitably fail. So whatever we think of the past, we must not be prisoners to it. Our problems must be dealt with through partnership. Our progress must be shared. Now, that does not mean we should ignore sources of tension. Indeed, it suggests the opposite. We must face these tensions squarely. And so, in that spirit, let me speak as clearly and as plainly as I can about some specific issues that I believe we must finally confront together. The first issue that we have to confront is violent extremism in all of its forms. In Ankara, I made clear that America is not and never will be at war with Islam. We will, however, relentlessly confront violent extremists who pose a grave threat to our security. Because we reject the same thing that people of all faiths reject, the killing of innocent men, women, and children. And it is my first duty as president to protect the American people. The situation in Afghanistan demonstrates America's goals and our need to work together. Over 7 years ago, the United States pursued Al-Qaeda and the Taliban with broad international support. We did not go by choice. We went because of necessity. I'm aware that there's still some who would question or even justify the offense of 9/11. But let us be clear. Al-Qaeda killed nearly 3,000 people on that day. The victims were innocent men, women, and children from America and many other nations who had done nothing to harm anybody. And yet Al-Qaeda chose to ruthlessly murder these people, claimed credit for the attack, and even now states their determination to kill on a massive scale. They have affiliates in many countries and are trying to expand their reach. These are not opinions to be debated. These are facts to be dealt with. Now, make no mistake, we do not want to keep our troops in Afghanistan. We seek no military bases there. It is agonizing for America to lose our young men and women. It is costly and politically difficult to continue this conflict. We would gladly bring every single one of our troops home if we could be confident that there were not violent extremists in Afghanistan and now Pakistan determined to kill as many Americans as they possibly can. But that is not yet the case. And that's why we're partnering with a coalition of 46 countries. And despite the costs involved, America's commitment will not weaken. Indeed, none of us should tolerate these extremists. They have killed in many countries. They have killed people of different faiths, but more than any other, they have killed Muslims. Their actions are irreconcilable with the rights of human beings, the progress of nations, and with Islam. The Holy Quran teaches that whoever kills an innocent is as if he has killed all mankind. And the Holy Quran also says, whoever saves a person, it is as if he has saved all mankind. The enduring faith of over a billion people is so much bigger than the narrow hatred of a few. Islam is not part of the problem in combating violent extremism. It is an important part of promoting peace. Now, we also know that military power alone is not going to solve the problems in Afghanistan and Pakistan. That's why we plan to invest $1.5 billion each year over the next 5 years to partner with Pakistanis to build schools and hospitals, roads and businesses, and hundreds of millions to help those who've been displaced. That's why we are providing more than $2.8 billion to help Afghans develop their economy and deliver services that people depend on. Now, let me also address the issue of Iraq. Unlike Afghanistan, Iraq was a war of choice that provoked strong differences in my country and around the world. Although I believe that the Iraqi people are ultimately better off without the tyranny of Saddam Hussein, I also believe that events in Iraq have reminded America of the need to use diplomacy and build international consensus to resolve our problems whenever possible. Indeed, we can recall the words of Thomas Jefferson, who said, "I hope that our wisdom will grow with our power and teach us that the less we use our power, the greater it will be." Today, America has a dual responsibility: to help Iraq forge a better future and to leave Iraq to Iraqis. And I have made it clear to the Iraqi people, that we pursue no bases and no claim on their territory or resources. Iraq's sovereignty is its own. And that's why I ordered the removal of our combat brigades by next August. That is why we will honor our agreement with Iraq's democratically elected government to remove combat troops from Iraqi cities by July, and to remove all of our troops from Iraq by 2012. We will help Iraq train its security forces and develop its economy, but we will support a secure and united Iraq as a partner and never as a patron. And finally, just as America can never tolerate violence by extremists, we must never alter or forget our principles. 9/11 was an enormous trauma to our country. The fear and anger that it provoked was understandable. But in some cases, it led us to act contrary to our traditions and our ideals. We are taking concrete actions to change course. I have unequivocally prohibited the use of torture by the United States, and I have ordered the prison at Guantanamo Bay closed by early next year. So America will defend itself, respectful of the sovereignty of nations and the rule of law. And we will do so in partnership with Muslim communities, which are also threatened. The sooner the extremists are isolated and unwelcome in Muslim communities, the sooner we will all be safer. Now, the second major source of tension that we need to discuss is the situation between Israelis, Palestinians, and the Arab world. America's strong bonds with Israel are well known. This bond is unbreakable. It is based upon cultural and historical ties and the recognition that the aspiration for a Jewish homeland is rooted in a tragic history that cannot be denied. Around the world, the Jewish people were persecuted for centuries, and anti-Semitism in Europe culminated in an unprecedented Holocaust. Tomorrow, I will visit Buchenwald, which was part of a network of camps where Jews were enslaved, tortured, shot, and gassed to death by the Third Reich. 6 million Jews were killed, more than the entire Jewish population of Israel today. Denying that fact is baseless, it is ignorant, and it is hateful. Threatening Israel with destruction or repeating vile stereotypes about Jews is deeply wrong and only serves to evoke in the minds of Israelis this most painful of memories while preventing the peace that the people of this region deserve. On the other hand, it is also undeniable that the Palestinian people, Muslims and Christians, has suffered in pursuit of a homeland. For more than 60 years, they've endured the pain of dislocation. Many wait in refugee camps in the West Bank, Gaza, and neighboring lands for a life of peace and security that they have never been able to lead. They endure the daily humiliations, large and small, that come with occupation. So let there be no doubt, the situation for the Palestinian people is intolerable, and America will not turn our backs on the legitimate Palestinian aspiration for dignity, opportunity, and a state of their own. For decades, then, there has been a stalemate. Two peoples with legitimate aspirations, each with a painful history that makes compromise elusive. It's easy to point fingers, for Palestinians to point to the displacement brought about by Israel's founding, and for Israelis to point to the constant hostility and attacks throughout its history, from within its borders as well as beyond. But if we see this conflict only from one side or the other, then we will be blind to the truth. The only resolution is for the aspirations of both sides to be met through two states where Israelis and Palestinians each live in peace and security. That is in Israel's interest, Palestine's interest, America's interest, and the world's interest. And that is why I intend to personally pursue this outcome with all the patience and dedication that the task requires. The obligations that the parties have agreed to under the roadmap are clear. For peace to come, it is time for them and all of us to live up to our responsibilities. Palestinians must abandon violence. Resistance through violence and killing is wrong, and it does not succeed. For centuries, black people in America suffered the lash of the whip as slaves and the humiliation of segregation. But it was not violence that won full and equal rights. It was a peaceful and determined insistence upon the ideals at the center of America's founding. This same story can be told by people from South Africa to South Asia, from Eastern Europe to Indonesia. It's a story with a simple truth. Violence is a dead end. It is a sign neither of courage nor power to shoot rockets at sleeping children or to blow up old women on a bus. That's not how moral authority is claimed. That's how it is surrendered. Now is the time for Palestinians to focus on what they can build. The Palestinian Authority must develop its capacity to govern with institutions that serve the needs of its peoples. Hamas does have support among some Palestinians, but they also have to recognize they have responsibilities. to play a role in fulfilling Palestinian aspirations, to unify the Palestinian people. Hamas must put an end to violence, recognize past agreements, recognize Israel's right to exist. At the same time, Israelis must acknowledge that just as Israel's right to exist cannot be denied, neither can Palestine's. The United States does not accept the legitimacy of continued Israeli settlements. This construction violates previous agreements and undermines efforts to achieve peace. It is time for these settlements to stop. And Israel must also live up to its obligation to ensure that Palestinians can live and work and develop their society. Just as it devastates Palestinian families, the continuing humanitarian crisis in Gaza does not serve Israel's security. Neither does the continuing lack of opportunity in the West Bank. Progress in the daily lives of the Palestinian people must be a critical part of a road to peace, and Israel must take concrete steps to enable such progress. And finally, the Arab states must recognize that the Arab Peace Initiative was an important beginning, but not the end of their responsibilities. The Arab-Israeli conflict should no longer be used to distract the people of Arab nations from other problems. Instead, it must be a cause for action to help the Palestinian people develop the institutions that will sustain their state, to recognize Israel's legitimacy, and to choose progress over a self-defeating focus on the past. America will align our policies with those who pursue peace. And we will say in public what we say in private to Israelis and Palestinians and Arabs. We cannot impose peace, but privately, many Muslims recognize that Israel will not go away. Likewise, many Israelis recognize the need for a Palestinian state. It is time for us to act on what everyone knows to be true. Too many tears have been shed. Too much blood has been shed. All of us have a responsibility to work for the day when the mothers of Israelis and Palestinians can see their children grow up without fear. When the holy land of the three great faiths is the place of peace that God intended it to be. When Jerusalem is a secure and lasting home for Jews and Christians and Muslims, and a place for all of the children of Abraham to mingle peacefully together, as in the story of Israel. As in the story of Israel, when Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad, peace be upon them, joined in prayer. The third source of tension is our shared interest in the rights and responsibilities of nations on nuclear weapons. This issue has been a source of tension between the United States and the Islamic Republic of Iran. For many years, Iran has defined itself in part by its opposition to my country. And there is, in fact, a tumultuous history between us. In the middle of the Cold War, the United States played a role in the overthrow of a democratically elected Iranian government. Since the Islamic Revolution, Iran has played a role in acts of hostage-taking and violence against U.S. troops and civilians. This history is well known. Rather than remain trapped in the past, I've made it clear to Iran's leaders and people that my country is prepared to move forward. The question now is not what Iran is against, but rather what future it wants to build. I recognize it will be hard to overcome decades of mistrust, but we will proceed with courage, rectitude, and resolve. There will be many issues to discuss between our two countries, and we are willing to move forward without preconditions on the basis of mutual respect. But it is clear to all concerned that when it comes to nuclear weapons, we have reached a decisive point. This is not simply about America's interests. It's about preventing a nuclear arms race in the Middle East that could lead this region and the world down a hugely dangerous path. Now, I understand those who protest that some countries have weapons that others do not. No single nation should pick and choose which nation holds nuclear weapons. And that's why I strongly reaffirmed America's commitment to seek a world in which no nations hold nuclear weapons. And any nation, including Iran, should have the right to access peaceful nuclear power if it complies with its responsibilities under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. That commitment is at the core of the treaty, and it must be kept for all who fully abide by it. And I'm hopeful that all countries in the region can share in this goal. The fourth issue that I will address is democracy. I know there has been controversy about the promotion of democracy in recent years, and much of this controversy is connected to the war in Iraq. So let me be clear. No system of government can or should be imposed by one nation by any other. That does not lessen my commitment, however, to governments that reflect the will of the people. Each nation gives life to this principle in its own way, grounded in the traditions of its own people. America does not presume to know what is best for everyone, just as we would not presume to pick the outcome of a peaceful election. But I do have an unyielding belief that all people yearn for certain things. The ability to speak your mind and have a say in how you are governed. Confidence in the rule of law and the equal administration of justice. Government that is transparent and doesn't steal from the people. The freedom to live as you choose. These are not just American ideas, they are human rights. And that is why we will support them everywhere. Now, there is no straight line to realize this promise. But this much is clear. Governments that protect these rights are ultimately more stable, successful, and secure. Suppressing ideas never succeeds in making them go away. America respects the right of all peaceful and law-abiding voices to be heard around the world, even if we disagree with them. And we will welcome all elected peaceful governments, provided they govern with respect for all their people. This last point is important because there are some who advocate for democracy only when they're out of power. Once in power, they are ruthless in suppressing the rights of others. So no matter where it takes hold, government of the people and by the people sets a single standard for all who would hold power. You must maintain your power through consent, not coercion. You must respect the rights of minorities and participate with a spirit of tolerance and compromise. You must place the interests of your people and the legitimate workings of the political process above your party. Without these ingredients, elections alone do not make true democracy.
We love you all!
Thank you. The fifth issue that we must address together is religious freedom. Islam has a proud tradition of tolerance. We see it in the history of Andalusia and Cordoba during the Inquisition. I saw it firsthand as a child in Indonesia, where devout Christians worshiped freely in an overwhelmingly Muslim country. That is the spirit we need today. People in every country should be free to choose and live their faith based upon the persuasion of the mind and the heart and the soul. This tolerance is essential for religion to thrive, but it's being challenged in many different ways. Among some Muslims, there's a disturbing tendency to measure one's own faith by the rejection of somebody else's faith. The richness of religious diversity must be upheld, whether it is for Maronites in Lebanon or the Copts in Egypt. And if we are being honest, fault lines must be closed among Muslims as well, as the divisions between Sunni and Shia have led to tragic violence, particularly in Iraq. Freedom of religion is central to the ability of peoples to live together. We must always examine the ways in which we protect it. For instance, in the United States, rules on charitable giving have made it harder for Muslims to fulfill their religious obligation. That's why I'm committed to working with American Muslims to ensure that they can fulfill zakat. Likewise, it is important for Western countries to avoid impeding Muslim citizens from practicing religion as they see fit, for instance, by dictating what clothes a Muslim woman should wear. We can't disguise hostility towards any religion behind the pretense of liberalism. In fact, faith should bring us together. And that's why we're forging service projects in America that bring together Christians, Muslims, and Jews. That's why we welcome efforts like Saudi Arabian King Abdullah's interfaith dialogue and Turkey's leadership in the Alliance of Civilizations. Around the world, we can turn dialogue into interfaith service, so bridges between peoples lead to action, whether it is combating malaria in Africa or providing relief after a natural disaster. The sixth issue that I want to address is women's rights. I know, and you can tell from this audience, that there is a healthy debate about this issue. I reject the view of some in the West that a woman who chooses to cover her hair is somehow less equal. But I do believe that a woman who is denied an education is denied equality. And it is no coincidence that countries where women are well educated are far more likely to be prosperous. Now, let me be clear. Issues of women's equality are by no means simply an issue for Islam. In Turkey, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Indonesia, we've seen Muslim-majority countries elect a woman to lead. Meanwhile, the struggle for women's equality continues in many aspects of American life and in countries around the world. I am convinced that our daughters can contribute just as much to society as our sons. Our common prosperity will be advanced by allowing all humanity, men and women, to reach their full potential. I do not believe that women must make the same choices as men in order to be equal. And I respect those women who choose to live their lives in traditional roles. But it should be their choice. And that is why the United States will partner with any Muslim-majority country to support expanded literacy for girls and to help young women pursue employment through microfinancing that helps people live their dreams. Finally, I want to discuss economic development and opportunity. I know that for many, the face of globalization is contradictory. The internet and television can bring knowledge and information, but also offensive sexuality and mindless violence into the home. Trade can bring new wealth and opportunities, but also huge disruptions and change in communities. In all nations, including America, this change can bring fear. Fear that because of modernity, we lose control over our economic choices, our politics, and most importantly, our identities, those things we most cherish about our communities, our families, our traditions, and our faith. But I also know that human progress cannot be denied. There need not be contradictions between development and tradition. Countries like Japan and South Korea grew their economies enormously while maintaining distinct cultures. The same is true for the astonishing progress within Muslim-majority countries from Kuala Lumpur to Dubai. In ancient times and in our times, Muslim communities have been at the forefront of innovation and education. And this is important because no development strategy can be based only upon what comes out of the ground, nor can it be sustained while young people are out of work. Many Gulf states have enjoyed great wealth as a consequence of oil, and some are beginning to focus it on broader development. But all of us must recognize that education and innovation will be the currency of the 21st century. And in too many Muslim communities, there remains underinvestment in these areas. I'm emphasizing such investment within my own country. And while America in the past has focused on oil and gas when it comes to this part of the world, we now seek a broader engagement. On education, we will expand exchange programs and increase scholarships, like the one that brought my father to America. At the same time, we will encourage more Americans to study in Muslim communities. And we will match promising Muslim students with internships in America, invest in online learning for teachers and children around the world, and create a new online network so a young person in Kansas can communicate instantly with a young person in Cairo. On economic development, we will create a new core of business volunteers to partner with counterparts in Muslim-majority countries. And I will host a summit on entrepreneurship this year to identify how we can deepen ties between business leaders, foundations, and social entrepreneurs in the United States and Muslim communities around the world. On science and technology, we will launch a new fund to support technological development in Muslim-majority countries, and to help transfer ideas to the marketplace so they can create more jobs. We'll open centers of scientific excellence in Africa, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia, and appoint new science envoys to collaborate on programs that develop new sources of energy, create green jobs, digitize records, clean water, grow new crops. Today, I'm announcing a new global effort with the Organization of the Islamic Conference to eradicate polio. And we will also expand partnerships with Muslim communities to promote child and maternal health. All these things must be done in partnership. Americans are ready to join with citizens and governments, community organizations, religious leaders, and businesses in Muslim communities around the world to help our people pursue a better life. And the issues that I have described will not be easy to address. But we have a responsibility to join together on behalf of the world that we seek. A world where extremists no longer threaten our people and American troops have come home. A world where Israelis and Palestinians are each secure in a state of their own. And nuclear energy is used for peaceful purposes. A world where governments serve their citizens and the rights of all God's children are respected. Those are mutual interests. That is the world we seek. But we can only achieve it together. I know there are many, Muslim and non-Muslim, who question whether we can forge this new beginning. Some are eager to stoke the flames of division and to stand in the way of progress. Some suggest that it isn't worth the effort, that we are fated to disagree, and civilizations are doomed to clash. Many more are simply skeptical that real change can occur. There's so much fear, so much mistrust that has built up over the years. But if we choose to be bound by the past, we will never move forward. And I want to particularly say this to young people of every faith, in every country. You, more than anyone, have the ability to reimagine the world, to remake this world. All of us share this world for but a brief moment in time. The question is whether we spend that time focused on what pushes us apart, or whether we commit ourselves to an effort, a sustained effort, to find common ground, to focus on the future we seek for our children, and to respect the dignity of all human beings. It's easier to start wars than to end them. It's easier to blame others than to look inward. It's easier to see what is different about someone than to find the things we share. But we should choose the right path, not just the easy path. There's one rule that lies at the heart of every religion, that we do unto others as we would have them do unto us. This truth transcends nations and peoples. A belief that isn't new, that isn't black or white or brown, that isn't Christian or Muslim or Jew. It's a belief that pulsed in the cradle of civilization and that still beats in the hearts of billions around the world. It's a faith in other people, and it's what brought me here today. We have the power to make the world we seek, but only if we have the courage to make a new beginning, keeping in mind what has been written. The Holy Quran tells us, O mankind, we have created you, male and a female, and we have made you into nations and tribes, so that you may know one another. The Talmud tells us, the whole of the Torah is for the purpose of promoting peace. The Holy Bible tells us, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. The people of the world can live together in peace. We know that is God's vision. Now that must be our work here on earth. Thank you. And may God's peace be upon you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
This is VOA's coverage of President Obama's address to Muslims around the world. President Obama had a number of things to say in his speech. He began by talking about his desire for a new beginning based on mutual interest and mutual respect. He called on confronting violent extremism in all its forms. He committed to personally working to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He talked about Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran. He touched on the need for democracy, human rights, and women's rights in the Muslim world. And he closed by saying that the people of the world can live together in peace. We're joined now. First, we invite you to share your thoughts on the speech with us by visiting us at voanews.com or sending a comment directly to obamaspeech@voanews.com. You can also share your feedback with us on Facebook and on Twitter, keyword Obama speech. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a central issue in improving relations between U.S. and Muslims. Joining me in Jerusalem to discuss that aspect of the speech is VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez, who is also joined by Mahdi Abdul Hadi, the founder and head of the Palestinian Academic Society for the Study of International Affairs, and Abraham Diskin, a political science researcher and former chair of the political science department at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Luis Ramirez, do you think that this changes the dynamic at all in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Well, certainly it does send a very strong message on the part of the U.S. president that he is considering the Israeli-Palestinian conflict a very high priority. The fact that he is taking it on, the issue on so early in his term, speaks a lot. One other element that shows the urgency that the president is attaching is the fact that he has made the trip to the Middle East. The speech has not been delivered from Washington or from New York. It has been delivered from a Muslim capital. That is certain to resonate among Palestinians, among Arabs who are as eager as everyone else to see a resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In his remarks, he did repeat a number of positions that the United States has taken, both in this administration and earlier administrations. He called for a stop, for an end to the existence, to the expansion of, the expansion of Jewish settlements on Palestinian lands. He called for Hamas to recognize Israel's right to exist. He said the only resolution to this Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a two-state solution. Also touched on a subject that is very important to Israel, and that is Iran's drive to develop its nuclear potential. He made a call to the Palestinians. He said they must renounce violence. He tried to balance his speech very much, saying that this is a stalemate.
Luis, let me pick up on that point and ask Mahdi Abdul Hadi on the question of renouncing violence and pursuing a peaceful solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. What are the chances that there is a move now to the Palestinian cause being pursued solely as one through nonviolent means?
Well, definitely the president was comparing the issue of violence not only limited to the domestic scene in Palestine and Israel, but he started talking about definitely the September 11th as well as the violence of Al-Qaeda, and then limited it to the issue today in what is happening in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And then he moved to mention all the basic major issues concerning the ordinary person in the street, in the Arab street, in the European street, in the US. He mentioned all the issues. He mentioned the refugees. He mentioned Jerusalem issue, should be Muslim, Christian, Jewish component in sharing the city. And he mentioned definitely the Jewish question in terms of what happened in the Holocaust. 6 million Jews were killed, and he's going to Europe to follow up on what is really happening during the Third Reich, and focusing definitely later on how Palestinians should have a state of their own, should have a freedom, independence, and ask the PA to reconstitute itself in terms of institutions, and move quickly to Hamas, focusing on not as a movement, Islamic movement or political Islam, but to be concerned about the Palestinian future, Palestinian society, Palestinian national aspiration in terms of the three conditions: recognizing Israel, renouncing violence, and violence is not the solution, as it is the war is not the solution in Iraq, and needs reconciliation and tolerance. He picked up for the Palestinian in particular the verses of the Quran, as it was for the Islamic world as well, in if you kill an innocent person as if you are killing all people, and if you save an innocent person as if you are saving all people. And he was touching on the hard issue, touching the mind and the heart of the individuals, not the organization, not the movement, but he's trying to reach everyone with everyone's interest according to everyone's dictionary, which means changing the tools of the game, changing the formats of the game, and changing the scene of the game. It is Palestine, Israel today is the core.
I'd like to bring in Abraham Diskin into the conversation and ask Mr. Diskin whether you think that Mr. Obama's speech in Cairo will do anything to promote his policy goals in Israel and to get more cooperation for the approach that he wants to take in trying to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
First of all, let me say that there's no question that Mr. Obama is a great speaker, a bright person, and I think that his speech was very moving. And one cannot but share almost every component of his vision. But at the same time, I'm quite afraid that it's going to be interpreted in a way that may bring just more bloodshed and more violence. And that's, of course, not his intention. And let me explain that by referring only to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Just a few days ago, Abu Mazen, probably the most moderate leader of the Palestinians ever, said in an interview with the Washington Post that his strategy is to wait. I'll wait. And he also mentioned that already Olmert, the last government in Israel, offered him to have 97% of the West Bank, recognize at least partially the right of return, etc. But he is going to wait. Why is he going to wait? Because, first of all, there is opposition inside the Palestinian society. I'm afraid that, unlike the desire of Mr. Obama, the Hamas is not going to accept the right of Israel to exist or the right of a Jewish state to exist. So he's pressured from within. And also he believes that maybe he can get more than 97%, maybe 99.5%, etc. Maybe a Palestinian state purified from hundreds of thousands of Jews who live, for instance, in the neighborhoods of Jerusalem, if he just leaves Obama to make pressure on Israel. So I'm afraid that this approach of Barack Obama, which is blessed, and I think one cannot but agree to the vision, will be interpreted as weakness, will invite more violence. etc.
I'd like to thank the VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez and also Mahdi Abdulhadi and Abraham Diskin from Jerusalem. I'd like to bring it back to our studio here in Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Mukhtadar Khan. And let's talk not only about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but the whole of the speech. What did you take away from this as the most important points?
Oh, it was a remarkable speech. It was full of insights. It was full of honesty, except for the case when he was talking about democracy. But it was also very inspirational, and I was honestly very moved by the speech. After I heard him speak in Turkey, I at that time thought that I couldn't have written a better speech than this, but apparently his imagination exceeds Muslim expectations. This was not a policy speech. It was not designed to say we will do this and you need to do this. This speech was designed to fundamentally change how Americans think about Muslims and how Muslims think about America. This is very important. This speech was not just addressing Muslims, it was also addressing Americans. He was trying to change the way we talk about Islam, the issues that divide us, and that is very important.
Well, let me jump and go to London, and where we're joined also by Mohammed Abdulbari, and Kabul, where we're joined by Wadir Safi. Mohammed Abdulbari in London, what did you take away primarily from the speech?
I think it's a brilliant speech, as usual. It's in his eloquence and presentation, and the whole speech, as he said, is a list of aspirations and coming from his heart, as it seems. And we share his aspiration, hopes, and the interpretation of history. but whether these aspirations will come to fruition, it all depends on how he works, because it's important that this aspiration comes from him, because he's the most powerful man on earth. So his aspirations hopefully will be translated into American policies, as well as he would be probably able to influence other governments, Western and Muslim governments, to more or less translate some of these hopes and aspirations into political realities, so that human beings coming from different backgrounds can live in peace and harmony.
And Wadir Safi, how are things seen in Afghanistan with this speech?
Yes, the speech was also very educational and knowledgeable. As for the Afghanistan question is also concerned, and especially in the part of fight against extremism, and non-reconciliation position against Al-Qaeda in the event of 9/11, what had happened. But at the same time assures Afghans and Afghan neighbors in the countries of the region and those who has an eye on Afghanistan that America doesn't want to have permanent bases in Afghanistan. It will withdraw as soon as Al-Qaeda is stopped and they don't have their safe havens anymore here, and also mentioned that it is not only the military way to solve this question, but economic development, cooperation, and respect the tradition and culture of these countries who are living here. And also he wants democracy for these people, not imposing it, but according to respect to the culture and traditional ways that these people wants themselves to come. He wants only not only to support the regimes, the governments, but also the organizations, civil societies, and the people of these countries. It was a big message, and I think Afghanistan people and the people in the region will also see it as their pathway to the changes in their future of this region as well.
Well, Mukhtadar Khan, on this point of democracy and human rights, in the speech, one of the largest responses, and perhaps not one that that Mr. Obama was expecting, came when he brought up the very notion of promoting democracy and promoting women's rights. What do you make of that?
Well, that was interesting. There has been criticism from Republicans in Washington that he may not talk about promoting democracy. But
there had also been some criticism from Egyptian dissidents.
Dissidents and across the Muslim world that he was choosing to speak from Cairo. But I also think that was the weakest link in his speech, because in his speech on democracy, he said, I'm committed to supporting those governments which responds to the genuine aspirations of his people. But apparently, if you look at the U.S. policy in the region, if you look at the Muslim Middle East, the only other democracies other than Turkey are Iran and Gaza. And the only elected governments that are there are in Iran and Hamas, and the United States has nothing to do with them. And the only people we seem to be interacting with are dictators and monarchs. So I think that was the every part of his speech was very honest and very frank, very balanced, but it was only on the subject of democracy that his words seemed to clash with even his own choice of speaking from Cairo.
Now, we've been receiving some emails, and one that we got from Indonesia, from Ramat Paranduri, sent us this via the VOA Facebook fan page. He said, quote, Muslims do not need simply a speech in any form. We need justice, fairness, and equality of opportunity. And in London, Muhammad Abdul Bari, what's your sense on how Mr. Obama can translate the notions in the speech into the kinds of practical things that the gentleman in Indonesia is looking for?
Well, I think the gentleman in Indonesia has spoken because probably we know especially after the Second World War, the U.S. Imposition in many countries, starting from Chile and other countries, on imposition of dictatorships over democracy is known. And President Obama has a hard job to convince people in the Muslim world and third world countries what really exactly he wants to bring in. And we believe his integrity, and we believe that he would be trying. But whether the overall American administration that he is heading is right or ripe for this this type of policy transformation, that's interesting to see. I think people in the Muslim world have really felt that U.S. Had been very unfair and unjust to not only certain Muslim countries, but a post-Second World War, third world and African countries as well.
Well, Muhammad Abdul Bari, what's your sense of the extent to which Mr. Obama has to deal with these sort of historical issues and the extent to which he deals with policy and realities at this point?
Well, one is convincing. He has come out very openly and frankly, and people do believe that he has a genuine intention to bring in change. But what I said, that what he has to prove that he has the determination and the policy to make these things happen, because there will be lots of resistance from the successive administrations that we have seen in America, and whether he is going to be able to do what he is telling us. That's most interesting for us to see.
Well, Wadi Safi in Kabul, does it matter at this point how the Muslim world responds to this gesture of reaching out to the Muslim world?
Yes, I think the Obama speech, and all in all, from the first to the end, after every second, after some sentences, he was quoting the Holy Quran and those parts of the Quran which brings the message of peace. And in fact, he confessed that the whole Quran is for peace, and this religion is for the peace. So we must not misuse it as some groups are doing it, as they are going to the extreme of that and gaining their own ideas and ends, political ends, naming them Islam. So it was very clear. I have not heard until now from none of the American presidents so much clear and knowledgeable speech about Islam, quoting it, and towards the Muslim.
especially in Afghanistan, since they are very linked in their past jihad also against the communists with the Arab world as well, they were very happy and they will be very happy and assured that the Palestine question is going to be solved by Americans. If the American president and this great power does not push one-sidedly, and it needs equal rights for both states and wants both states to be existed and live in peace. This is a very big message, and I can tell you from our point of view that if the Middle East question is solved by America, so it can really be the world of the leader of the whole world. If it is not solved, it cannot claim to be sustainable in keeping the leadership of the world.
Well, Mukhtar Khan, is it up to the U.S. to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or is there a big role to be had by the Muslim world in reciprocating President Obama's gesture of trying to dive in and resolve the conflict?
Well, the United States is a critical player. The United States has been the longest supporter of Israel in this issue and has strengthened Israel in many ways economically and politically. But I think that as long as the U.S. plays the honest broker's role, it can advocate peace and advance the cause of peace, but not really make peace. Two things have to happen. The Israelis and the Palestinians should want to live in peace and should be willing to make the sacrifices and the compromises to achieve that peace. If they do not want to make the sacrifices that they have to make to get peace, then they will never have peace. Plus, the role of Arab states and other states in the region, such as Turkey and Iran, has to become more positively inclined towards achieving peace for the Palestinians and the Israelis. I don't think that any of the states in the region are doing enough. Everyone is sitting back and expecting Obama to wave a magic wand and solve all the problems of the Muslim world. That is not going to happen. Obama can take one step towards in the right direction, but I think if everybody is not marching in step with him, we will not get there.
Mohammed Abdul Bari, the leaders of al-Qaeda had encouraged Muslims not to listen to this speech. By contrast, President Obama was hoping to use this speech to speak to the hearts and minds, as he said, of people that al-Qaeda might try to recruit from. How do you think that played out in this speech?
Well, al-Qaeda doesn't represent the Muslim world. They are a fringe group of people who have taken that path, and the whole Muslim world, scholars, political leaders, countries have rejected them. But the fact that President Obama has spoken in Egypt, one of the seats of Islamic civilization, is important. But the most important fact is I would place the Palestine-Israeli issue as number one. Well, of course, violent extremism is a thing that needs to be addressed, but many of the things that we see in the world today come out of that. But here is in Israel, there is a right-wing government who denies all sorts of things, and there has been a historic injustice done to Palestinians. Look at the map of Palestine in 1948 and 2009. So all these things are embedded. Well, historic injustice was done to Jews in Europe as well, but these two were unconnected. Somehow, Palestinian people have been brought in, unfortunately, by the former superpower. So these are big, deep issues, and President Obama has a really hard task ahead if he wants to bring in peace. And I believe if he really tries, he can bring a semblance of justice and sanity in that part of the world.
Well, Wadi Safi, we have a little less than a minute left, but what's your sense in Afghanistan? Did President Obama do anything to dent the appeal of al-Qaeda and its allies in the Taliban?
Yes, in Afghanistan, the war already is going on in Pakistan, especially towards Swat. It is, I think, a decisive war, and it can set back the al-Qaeda and their allies there. But still, the main center of al-Qaeda, which is active, and it is going to be like a government in the government, which is situated in Waziristan, the that also needs a very serious step against them. But what is now known by the people of this region in Afghanistan and Pakistan, by the masses, this is that this illegitimacy of Al-Qaeda organization. What this Al-Qaeda has brought to Afghanistan, what Al-Qaeda has brought to Pakistan. Now the people of both countries, they know that instead destruction, the bloodshed, the killing of the people, if this is Islam, this is wrong.
I'm afraid that's going to have to be the last word. It's going to have to be the last word for today because we're out of time. But I'd like to thank all our guests and also VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez from Jerusalem. For more reaction to President Obama's Cairo speech, be sure to visit voanews.com. And for further coverage, be sure to tune in to VOA TV and radio. For VOA News, I'm Eric Felton.